The way you got started back in that generation is you'd build a services company. A lot of the early funding and revenue and customers was actually often done by services, custom projects. And then there's a playbook that everyone ran back then, which is you do that for a bit and then you'd pivot that into a product company. You learn to figure out what your customers need, want, their pain points, and that leads you to product. So when we started the company, we said, hey, this is an area that we want to solve for. Let's make life easier for technology leaders. But we actually didn't presume we knew what the product was. We didn't know what the MVP, to your question, was going to be like. My name is Andrew Lau, co-founder and CEO of Jellyfish.
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries.
It's 6 months moonlighting.
There's nothing on the back end.
Who share what it takes to change an industry.
I don't exactly know what to do next.
It took many goes to get right.
Who built the teams that have their back.
The company is its people.
The teams help each other achieve.
I was proud of our team.
Keeping scalability top of mind.
All that infrastructure was a
pain. Yes, we've been fighting it as we grow.
Total waste of time. The stories you don't read in the headlines.
It's not an easy thing to achieve, mind
you. Took it off the shelf and dusted it off and tried it again.
To ride the ups and downs of the startup life.
You need to really want it.
It's not just about technology.
All this and more on Code Story. I'm your host, Noah Labhart, and today how Andrew Lau is helping you drive engineering with clarity, combining issues and data to build effective R&D. This episode is sponsored by Speakeasy. Grow your API user adoption and improve engineering velocity with friction-free integration experiences. With Speakeasy's platform, you can now automatically generate SDKs in 10 languages and Terraform providers in minutes. Visit speakeasy.com/codestory and generate your first SDK for free. This message is sponsored by QA Wolf. QA Wolf gets engineering teams to 80% automated end-to-end test coverage and helps them ship 5 times faster by reducing QA cycles from hours to minutes. With over 100 five-star reviews on G2 and customer testimonials from SalesLoft, Drata, and AutoTrader, you're in good hands. Join the Wolfpack at qawolf.com. Andrew Lau is located in Boston now, but is a California native. He grew up in Oakland and calls himself the odd duck who went west instead of east, like most people. He went to the Northeast for school and stayed to be a part of the startup world, interestingly enough with his current co-founders. But outside of tech, he's married to an AP calculus teacher and has 2 daughters. He enjoys cooking and making new cuisine with his kids. Fun fact, he is a certified barbecue judge in Kansas City and has come to Texas a time or two to tour the Texas Monthly List. Andrew met his current co-founders in 1999. Years later, they reconnected, recalling the successes and camaraderie they had during their startup days. They recalled that the act of leading engineering teams was hard, and they wanted to build something that made it easier. This is the creation story of Jellyfish.
We build tools to help engineering leaders lead their teams. And this could be everything from CTOs and interfacing with the other executives and boards to making sure a project you're working on is getting resourced and delivered on time to, if you're like a manager, making sure that each of the members of your team succeed by making sure that they're getting what they need and are supported. Me, Dave, and Phil worked together 26 years ago we met. But we reconnected in 2017 professionally and we said we wanted to do something together just because out of respect and intentionality and just like really had a lot of fun in the journey, but also wanted to do it together. And so we actually decided a lot about the principles that we want to do even before the concept. But Jellyfish, the concept really was born out of our careers. I started as an engineer, so like engineering to engineering management, some folks in product. And we just said, hey, the art of leading teams is hard. In some ways, there's so much innovation. The way that folks code today is definitely not the way that I learned to code. But I think the leadership actually has been limited in the innovation here. And so we actually wanted to make it easier for leaders. And I use the broad definition of leaders, whether you're a team lead, an architect, executive, like the act of leading technology teams is hard. And so we really wanted to add some flair, innovation there, and actually make lives easier for all those leaders.
Let's dive into the MVP for Jellyfish, that first version of the product you built. How long did it take to build, and what sort of tools were used to bring it to life?
So in that 1990s company, the way you got started back in that generation is you'd build a services company. A lot of the early funding and revenue and customers was actually often done by services, custom projects. And then there's a playbook that everyone ran back then, which is you do that for a bit and then you'd pivot that into a product company. There's two reasons people did it. One, which is get money from it, which we didn't borrow that part of it, but we actually borrowed the, you learn to figure out what your customers need, want, their pain points, and it leads you to product. So we really took that as a template. So when we started the company, we said, hey, this is an area that we want to solve for. Let's make life easier for technology leaders. But we actually didn't presume we knew what the product was. We didn't know what the MVP, to your question, was going to be like. And we said, we have to learn from folks. And so what we did is we immediately called folks that we'd done research with. First 20 folks we interviewed, and so we called them all back and said, hey, we're actually going to do this company now, but can we work with you to figure out what this is? We want to help solve the problem space we researched with you. Can we help you? And so we'll do whatever you need as a leader, whether it be your spreadsheets or your project forecasting or your budget planning or your slides, and we'll work with you in that way. And we'll do it for free and we'll do it with you as long as we can have access to your tools, your digital tools, because we knew this is the problem space we wanted to solve for. And we also knew that over time it was going to be a digital platform. So we wanted access to all the tools the engineers were using and they were using. And so that meant at the time, the Jiras, the GitHubs, the roadmap tools, the spreadsheets, all that stuff. And so it could be something as simple as making a slide. Hey, a CFO is looking for this from me, or hey, can you help me forecast this stuff? And so we do it by hand initially, and then we automate some of it. And then we take that automation and bring it to the next guy or gal and say, you have a problem. It sounds like Jessica's problem. We did this. Would you find this useful? We bounce between kind of stuff done by hand, custom hacky code, till we found people with common problem spaces. And that really became the kernel of what became our MVP. I don't actually think it was like a single binary moment. It was a continuous iteration of that gray area between custom random by hand stuff to at some point a collection of code that was doing idiomatically a sequence of things that provided value to people. It took a while. Like we did that for, this may sound dramatic, but a couple years. I think everybody wishes everything's like a flash in a pan, but I think it takes time to get there. And on the flip side, it doesn't mean that time will equate solving it either, but it might take time. We flipped that over and started selling it.
This message is sponsored by SnapTrade. Link in user brokerage accounts and build world-class investing experiences with SnapTrade's unified brokerage API. With over $12 billion in connected assets and over 300,000 connected accounts, SnapTrade's API quality and developer experience are second to none. SnapTrade is SOC 2 certified and uses industry-leading security practices. Developers can use the company's official client SDKs to build investing experiences in minutes without the limitations of traditional aggregators. Get started for free today by visiting snaptrade.com/codestory.
I'm so pumped about my new offshore dev partner. I'm saving a ton, and they even signed an NDA. Wait, is that our financial statements on the internet?
My dev partner has great communication. They can acknowledge an issue or email message super fast after they run it through Google Translate, of course.
I have a call set up with my partner right now. Hey, guys. Guys, are you there? Wait, did you just ghost me?
Ever been in these situations? Yeah, me too. That is, until I found Tekla. Tekla is world-class, nearshore talent for technology teams who demand the highest standards. The platform gives you access to over 50,000 vetted Latin America technology experts, including developers, designers, and IT professionals, all fluent in English and all in your time zone. In 7 days or less, you can have your tech expert hired through Tekla's fast, efficient hiring process, which helps you find and onboard top candidates. Get senior-level talent at competitive rates, often half the cost of hiring in the U.S., but aligned with U.S. work culture and time zones, making teamwork easy and productive. Hire the best tech experts today with Tekla. Learn more at tekla.io. That's T-E-C-L-A.io. This episode is sponsored by Speakeasy. Whether you're growing the user adoption of your public API or streamlining internal development, SDKs can turn the chore of API integration into effortless implementation. Unburden your API users from guessing their way around your API while keeping your team focused on your product. Shorten the time to live integration and provide a delightful experience for your customers. With Speakeasy's platform, you can now automatically generate up-to-date, robust, idiomatic SDKs in 10 languages and Terraform providers in just a matter of minutes. SDKs are feature-rich with type safety, auto-retries, and pagination. Everything you need to give your API the developer experience it deserves. Deliver a premium API experience without the premium price tag. Visit speakeasy.com/codestory to get started and generate your first SDK for free. So then from that point, I'm curious how you matured the product and how you progressed it. And I think to wrap it in a box a little bit, what I'm looking for is how you built your roadmap, how you went about deciding that, okay, this was the next most important thing to build or to address with Jellyfish.
Oh, gee, I wish there was a single bullet that could fit in a blog to describe that. I actually think that is the product founder art that we all are learning together on that stuff. Look, at some point we had like 10 alphas, and then we were like, we needed to start selling something. And so we actually started turning that around and actually started cold calling people. We ran out of people we knew and said, hey, would this be useful to you? And of course the answer is no, or maybe if. And those maybe ifs or the no and whys became the roadmap items. And I think as a founder, you're prioritizing those no's and whys by cost, by the market you seek, the size of company, the persona, the problem space. That art is, to your point, crafting that roadmap and deciding what to do and what not to do is what defines the first kind of iteration of the company. I think when companies get more mature, and I don't know what revenue number, but at some point, like when you're actually prioritizing product choices by a pure spreadsheet of this revenue and this TAM and this customer base, then I think that's a different conversation. That's more kind of contemporary product management and product leadership. I think we're both talking about the stage before then, before you can use numbers alone to make the decisions.
Okay, so then I'm curious about team. Right? How did you go about building team? And it's absolutely critical to have the right team in place. And what did you look for in those people to indicate that they are the winning horses to join you?
I'll give you the cheesy answer. Number one, they got to be good people and good communicators. And I think that good people is a broad definition. That's a sensibility that you're willing to spend time together, to work through arguments together, and like willingness to want to be together. And of course, they need to have good mental horsepower and willingness to be dynamic on that stuff. And then, of course, then you've got technical capability, which I'm sure this whole audience knows how to actually read for. I think the first 10 people on the team were technical. Like, I would argue to that point of product market fit. Like, again, I sometimes hate that word because it feels so binary, like you have it or you don't. And I think we all know you're always chasing it. You're never there. Before that illustrious point, I think you're all makers and inventors and not scalers. And so everybody has to be involved in making. We drew on networks we knew that could help establish the trust of the good people part of it. That's the easy part. I think that you get to do that as you get older because you have broader networks you can draw on and you have better sensibility of what trust and good people mean. And then I think you start looking for areas that complement things. For example, I think my co-founder Dave is more of a back-end guy. I'm more all stack guy before they cut me out of the code base. My co-founder Phil is a little bit more on the product go-to-market side, so like err in that direction. At certain points I'm like, hey, we need people that actually have deeper DevOps-y skill just because we need to stand up a bunch of services, or we needed someone that actually just had a lot more kind of generation one AI kind of in data science knowledge, or hey, we needed someone that actually can do more UI panache than I can and was more upstack on that stuff. We started on a Django kind of Postgres stack, so we need some more back-end kind of Postgres kind of experience on stuff. So implicit in what I'm saying, though, is the kind of first 10, 20 customers, real customers, money customers, are actually founder sold, right? So we were pretty tech product heavy people for the first tech 10 people, as opposed to an optimizer or a scaler, because you can be what you said, but not a builder. You know what I mean?
This message is sponsored by QA Wolf. If slow QA process is bottlenecking your software engineering team and you're releasing slower because of it, you need a solution. You need QA Wolf. QA Wolf gets engineering teams to 80% automated end-to-end test coverage and helps them ship 5 times faster by reducing QA cycles from hours to minutes. With over 100 five-star reviews on G2 and customer testimonials from SalesLoft, Drata, AutoTrader, and many more, you're in good hands. Ready to ship faster with fewer bugs? Join the Wolfpack at QAWolf.com to see if they can help you squash the QA bottleneck. This message is sponsored by SnapTrade. Link in user brokerage accounts and build world-class investing experiences with SnapTrade's unified brokerage API. With over $12 billion in connected assets and over 300,000 connected accounts, SnapTrade's API quality and developer experience are second to none. SnapTrade is SOC 2 certified and uses industry-leading security practices. Developers can use the company's official client SDKs to build investing experiences in minutes without the limitations of traditional aggregators. Get started for free today by visiting snaptrade.com/codestory. I'm curious about scalability, right? Let's go to the future, right? Let's go to the part where you need that optimization. I'm curious if there have been interesting areas in scalability, either that you took an interesting approach or that you had to fight it as you grew.
I hate the concept of building for scale before you see it. I just feel like that is a trap that many people fall into. It's not that I don't agree with scale, but I think it's very hard in startup land to know what kind of scale you're going to hit. So like I've just been part of so many teams where you build for a kind of scale that never arises. It slows you down, like opportunity cost, because you're not figuring out the next product market fit or something like that. But also, it may actually slow you down from a form of liability where the inverse of some optimization in one direction slows you down in a different dimension. So I think premature optimization is a really dangerous thing for scale. The other side of that, though, is that means you have to expect you are going to hit scale walls on the other side of it. And you have to be ready to pay for it on the other side. And pay for it is not just in engineering time or dollar cost, but like it's going to be grumpiness and hyperbole. How could we not let this? How do we let this happen? Well, that was the trade we made to get from A to B. So I think that is a general theme that I think you have to stomach. You'd love to always look around the corner. I'm just saying in startup land, it's very hard to know what the next corner looks like. I think instead, again, all relative to the stage you're at, but understanding how to be agile to smell the stage shifts and smell the scale and difficulty on that stuff. There's a lot of stuff like just even today that I don't think we would have actually expected. We had a customer recently which had more Git repos than the number of engineers they actually have. And that seems weird, right? I'm guessing for most members of the team, you're like, why would you lay it out that way? Or maybe some people are like, maybe that's normal, right? But it also meant it's just like a different form of scale. Like you've got to be able to work through a plethora of repos that you never thought you were going to. And so I don't know if you could have preordained that was a scaling challenge.
So as you step out on the balcony, look across all that you've built with Jellyfish, what are you most proud of?
I'm proud of the fact that we've largely stuck to our mission and what we're actually trying to do. We're still in the vein of helping engineering leaders succeed in what they're doing because I think the job is hard. We said that from the very first moment what we're actually in it for, and we've stuck by that. Now, the flavor has changed. The domain has changed. We weren't talking about coding assistants 7 years ago. So the flavor changes, but our mission still stays the same. So I'm proud of that. I'm also proud of like making this work for our team and business. I remember a conversation we had as co-founders, and at the time, a couple of us had really young kids. I think mine was 2 and 4. We, as founders, opted into the startup, and we knew what it meant. Like, it's hard. But like, I had young kids. I have to go home and get them from daycare or make dinner. And I can't do the stereotype of the 20-year-old eating ramen till 1 in the morning. At the point in life, I can't do that. And we know how hard a startup is. And so we were very conscious early on to saying, hey, we have to make this work for us and our team. And so I think that was for us like an intentionality on making it work. And that means that we work hard, but we have to do it our own way. And we have to make the mix and combination for the team and situation that we can succeed in that as an example. So I'm proud of those things amongst many, but those are things that quickly I think of here.
let's flip the script then. Tell me about a mistake you made and how you and your team responded to it.
Number one, I don't like to live in regret. That's not my style. Like, I actually think we as individuals and as company are the byproduct of the journey we took. I'll actually give you an actual answer. Despite this being a relatively technical audience and podcast, I'll give you the opposite answer. Me and my co-founders, we went through and in our previous companies, I think we actually said early on, like probably we're like under-marketed in some of the companies we've been in the past. We sat there together as founders. We're not going to do that. We're going to make sure that we appropriately get the marketing thing going. Looking back, I still think we started too late. I think we started too late with kind of marketing, blogging, telling our story, telling what our customers are up to and what we're trying to do. I think we started too late. And I think it came out of, I think, our engineer introversion shyness. I think we're earnest as engineers. We don't like to say things that aren't true or speak ahead of that stuff. And so we're like, we got to make everything work right before you can actually announce it and do that thing. And it's true. Like, I think we have integrity. We want to do that. At the same time, there's a lot of marketing that has nothing to do with that stuff. It's about finding your voice, talking to your audience that may not have to do with your product. It does in the sense it's your domain and people, but it takes a while to figure out those muscles and how to do it. I'm just saying for people like me that might be natural introverts in this stuff and shy about those things to push yourself. And it doesn't mean that you're talking about your product when it's not ready, but you can start talking to your audience in space much earlier. Like, we probably didn't get in gear on that stuff till, like 2020 maybe? I don't know, it's crazy. We probably should have started in 2018. If you had talked to Andrew Brain back then, they'd be like, there's no product to talk about. But we could have actually started talking about the difficulty in leading teams and starting conversations with people. And that would have laid the groundwork both for our own muscles and ability, but also then allowing us to ramp up from there. I know that's not a technology thing, but I think it's in the personality type for a lot of us.
This message is sponsored by Vanta. Trust isn't just earned, it's demanded. Whether you're a startup founder navigating your first audit or a seasoned security professional scaling your GRC program, proving your commitment to security has never been more critical or more complex. That's where Vanta comes in. Businesses use Vanta to establish trust by automating compliance for in-demand frameworks like SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. And with automation and AI throughout the platform, you can proactively manage vendor risk and complete security questionnaires up to 5 times faster, getting valuable time back. Vanta can also save you money. A new IDC white paper found that Vanta customers achieve $535,000 per year in benefits. So the platform pays for itself in just 3 months. Join over 10,000 global companies like Atlassian, Quora, and Factory who use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. For a limited time, listeners get $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/codestory. That's vanta.com/codestory for $1,000 off. Let's talk about the future. What's the future for Jellyfish, for the product, for the team, and everything you've got going on there?
It's really hard to call shots on the future in the world today. It is changing so darn fast. If you just look at the last 4 years, I don't think any of us could have guessed every 6 months how much the world flips left and right on that stuff. I'll stand to our mission, right? Our mission still is to help leaders be more successful in leading their teams, and that might mean tying into their business or helping enable their teams, like individuals of their teams or sub-teams to be successful, whether it's quantitative or qualitative or whatever flavor is there. Given that our mission has held for the last 7 years, I'm going to say it's going to keep holding, right, on that part of it. I think we're going to start reaching different kinds of companies, right? So we started originally helping companies like ourselves, SaaS software companies at a certain size. And I think the world is changing for us a lot. We're now reaching companies that, you know, software ate the world, but they're companies that probably don't identify as pure software companies. And so we're going to end up reaching lots more broader industries, different teams accordingly. So I think like mission stays the same. Who we're serving and growing to and reaching gets wider. And as you follow that arc, then I think it leads to often incrementally related problems, different problems around different personas when you're an engineering team of 20 people, like, it's just a bunch of engineers, some architects, and some builders. But as you get bigger, you've suddenly got project managers and PMOs, and you've got people interfacing with finance, and you have different kinds of leaders. You have folks working on platform teams, and you got folks working on experience, and you have folks working on dev tools and DevOps. And so you've got all these different kind of personas, which all lead to a subslice or nuanced parts of the problems. So I think those are thematically where we're heading towards, touching more, bigger, louder on that stuff. Now, I think we're in the middle of a big revolution right now. Look, I think we all know it from a user and technologist touching the tools perspective, but I don't think we fully together understand or know it when it comes to the business or the organizational changes that come about. And I think for us, it's going to be supporting those transitions. So like right now, I think if you're like an engineering leader, you probably all bought some coding assistant tool. You probably all are using Copilot and all the various different flavors on that stuff. A lot of organizations right now are going through transitions around how do we make sure it works for everybody? How do we make sure we're getting the yield we desire out of this? How are people actually unlocking the value out of those things? And I think that's going to change. And it's going to change what's the mix of folks you need to hire? Like, how do we plan for it? What does it mean to all the ceremonies and rituals we actually do? And so supporting that kind of change. But what about all the different agents that are coming? So what about coding assistants that were today? What about code reviews? What about writing documentation? What about writing tests? What about database schemas? What about DevOps tools? What about actually things around deployment, right? Like, if we arrive at a fully agentic world, how does that fit in? Do the roles of product managers change? So all of those things are going to be a whole bunch of new tools, whole bunch of impacts to the team. And so the active leadership, whether, again, as a manager, a project manager, product manager, or an executive, are all changing along the way. And so I think we're building a lot in those trajectories too. And that might mean helping the people or helping the leaders and helping the agents be effective too. I just think there's a ton of change coming that's going to play out in the next 5 years. In some ways, we all know the tactical changes we're being hit with today. And then we also know like the visionary, like the agents will rule them all kind of vision speak. But I think none of us know what it's going to look like from A to B. And that's, I think, where we're going to provide a lot of value and help for folks.
Andrew, let's switch to you. Who influences the way that you work? Name a person or many persons or something you look up to and why.
I'll give you a seemingly cheesy one, but it's true. It's actually my mom. My mom was an engineer. She's a software engineer before software engineers exist. And she was a math major who learned to code on punch cards. Like, I learned how to code from her on that stuff. And I remember she had a TN3270 kind of terminal at home with a modem that dialed in. That's what I remember her doing. I remember her like working with me on my old Apple IIc in BASIC. I'm a VI guy, and I think one of the reasons I learned both early. I think my co-founder Dave, because I met him 26 years ago, he actually gave me a thing. He's like, why did he end up being a VI guy too? It's because back then on those old Sun workstations or whatever workstation you're working on, you couldn't be guaranteed Emacs installed, but VI was always on bare metal, so you could always get it, right? It was pretty low end. Back in the middle aughts, I was doing some pair coding with someone in VI, and they were like looking at my shoulder. And I think I was doing a find replace thing. And I started doing this weird key combo. And I'm like doing this sequence. They're like, what is that? And I was like, I don't know. I'm doing a search replace. They're like, that's not how you do it. And like, I did a thing and it actually worked. And this person was like, this is crazy. I don't know what you just did. And I realized what happened was I learned that from my mom. When she was coding, line editors where you could only read one line at a time coming out of a printer, which is freaking crazy, was one of her early editors. And back then, I think the editor was called Ed. And there was a key combo sequence around search replace that she learned from that she taught to me that VI inherited, even though it wasn't a VI native thing. So I learned a weirdo line editor search replace macro from my mom back in the day. So literal inspiration and tactical like macros I learned from my mom around coding. So inspiration there.
That's super cool. I love that story. Okay, Andrew, last question. So you're getting on a plane and you're sitting next to a young entrepreneur who's built the next big thing. They're jazzed about it. They can't wait to show it off to the world and can't wait to show it off to you right there on the plane. What advice do you give that person, having gone down this road a bit?
Number one, my idealism is that person will succeed, period. Because they're on a plane talking about their stuff. That means they're excited about it. my kind of positivity in the world is that person will end up somewhere great. I just don't know how, where. So that starts a baseline. So any of my advice is about thematic and bigger things than it is today, because I probably can't help him or her today. But my thematic things to that person as an engineer, two simple things. I think number one, just like when in doubt, follow good people, right? Just stick around good people. If they're teaching you, if they're exciting you, if they're willing to bring you along, just stick around with them, whatever that means. That could be an employee, it could be an investor, it could be a mentor. Just stay around them, right? They'll take care of you, or a manager, right? Just follow them. Number two, as an engineer, I'll speak to my own shyness and all this stuff, like learn to sell, man. Everything we do, as much as we are technologists and engineers, in some ways as engineers, we're taught to debug and find the failure cases. We're almost taught how to find where things are gonna fail. We're teaching ourselves how things will fail. We're taught to find the no. As an entrepreneur, you need to learn to sell. So selling, I think it sounds like such a dirty word in engineering land, because it sounds like you're lying to me. It's not lying to people. It's like getting through the hoop on this stuff. It's about getting to yes. And that might mean like selling your first customer, or getting your first pilot, or getting someone to work with you, whether they're an employee, a teammate, a co-founder, or a customer doing an alpha, right? And selling is like fundraising. That's selling too. You got to learn to do it and get yourself out of the shyness, make repetitions, do things that make you uncomfortable and get there. I think engineers just need to do more of that stuff. On the pure entrepreneurial part, one thing I've seen with a lot of younger entrepreneurs is, boy, is there so much great lit out there today. Jeez, even podcasts like this, right? Like, there's so much good content out there. Like, I meet young entrepreneurs and they are way effing smarter than me about everything, like dealing with cap tables and all this stuff. They just are smarter on these things. Like, I met this one entrepreneur and they would shred me around, did you know what this term means? You've done this, da 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 da. And I'm like, darn, I can't keep up. But I think in some ways that over-education on that stuff is they're overly confident, reliant on those things, and they forget the other part, which is spend time on relationships. Because sometimes those same people go like, why am I going to spend time developing a relationship with that person? Or they burn this person. And you're like, transactionally, the moment I agree with you, I don't see the tactical value today on that stuff. But what have I learned in my almost 30 years in career here? It's a long game. Treat people right, spend time on it. You don't know how it's going to help you, but it will over time. It's 1+1=5 on these things. And spend time in those relationships. It may not, no blog says it, there's no rule, there's no cap table term, but just treat people right and invest in relationships, because it'll pay dividends over time.
No, those are solid. That's fantastic advice. Well, Andrew, thank you for being on the show today, and thank you for telling the creation story of Jellyfish.
Thank you for having me.
And this concludes another chapter of Code Story. Code Story is hosted and produced by Noah Labhart. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. And when you get a chance, leave us a review. Both things help us out tremendously. And thanks again for listening.
What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money, like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast, and increase your earning power today.